Hello and welcome to the Rights and Rule podcast. My name is Jimmy and I'm one of the deplorables that voted to leave the EU in 2016.
Hello, and I'm Jazza, and I went to an improv study group yesterday, and one of the scenes that we had to do was pretend that we were in a non-Brexit Britain. We performed incredibly well, it was all very moving, but then I had to go home and weep for the country that once was.
Is that story true?
Yes, it's 100%.
Oh my god. Well, sorry, I guess.
We meet every week, more or less, to talk about social issues, current events, and politics. Jimmy, you don't know this. Well, you do know that we're in different places right now. We're recording this over Skype, although there are other kind of like calling softwares available. And I'm actually...
Are there, though?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, monopoly tech sector. They might as well not be.
I don't know. Facebook... calls are now a thing.
Cool. If you're quite done advertising your former employer's products, then yeah.
Also Google Hangouts, etc., etc.,
etc., etc. As you were saying.
Yeah, as I was saying, I'm actually recording this in my pants and a vest.
Which is a change for you, because usually it's shorts all the way.
Yeah, I like to expose as much skin as possible because I'm very sweaty.
Thanks for that. What are we going to be discussing this week, Jazza, apart from your underwear?
Well, was it last week that we talked about Catalonia?
It was 2 weeks ago now.
It's 2 weeks ago. Okay, I feel less bad about us doing it 2 weeks on a trot now. But basically, the Catalans had their independence referendum and shit hit the fan, like, big time. People were camped out in the polling stations, which were often... schools and the like, in order to stop the federal police from being able to occupy those places and stop people from voting. Like something like 2.5 million people actually managed to vote on the day, but there was a lot of violence. Like hundreds of people have been injured because of the scuffles between people who were trying to vote and the federal police who were deployed
there. One guy lost an eye, actually, from a rubber bullet.
God.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's pretty bad. Yeah. And then there was also a video I saw of a man, like an older guy, who was being manhandled by the police, who started having a panic attack on the floor. So the images were pretty fucking bad.
Yeah, and this is, although it's a relatively new democracy, Spain became a democracy in 1975 after the dictator Franco died. This is kind of, well, it disturbed me anyway to see these kinds of scenes in a Western prosperous democracy. Anyway, we'll talk about that. I did a video on it on my channel as well.
It's a good video. I actually watched it this time. I don't watch most of Jazza's content, so.
You're a bastard, but I...
A little plug.
Usually, guys, my content's shit, but apparently Jimmy approved it. It's fine.
Well, I wouldn't know. I don't watch most of it. So. Sorry, I'll try.
No, it's okay. I never read any of your articles. So,
I mean, I don't write any.
Yeah.
Most of the time. So yeah. Yeah, exactly. So speaking of, you know, disastrous images at the Tory conference, Theresa May gave her, I suppose it's still called a keynote speech, but the sort of main speech of the event as Prime Minister of the UK and leader of the Tory party, and pretty much everything went wrong that could conceivably go wrong, including the comedian Simon Brodkin approaching the stage and handing her a P45, which for our international listeners is the form you get handed when you get fired from a job. And then some of the signage at the back of the stage fell off and Theresa May just sort of collapsed into a coughing fit.
Yeah.
Not actually collapsing, but you know.
Like everything about her apart from her stature collapsed. Like she was handed a lozenge by the Chancellor of the Exchequer halfway through. Yeah, man, it was painful. I mean, I feel so sorry for her. You know what was like a happy kind of positive for her on this? At least that speech going so wrong that nobody could talk about anything else stopped people from talking about the possibility of Boris Johnson trying to overthrow her as the Prime Minister.
Is this another one of Lee Crosby's dead cat kind of scenarios? Maybe it was all pre-planned.
Perhaps. Yeah. Maybe she just deliberately screwed the whole thing up so that people would stop talking about Boris Johnson.
Maybe. Maybe they actually hired Simon Brodkin and then told him to do what he did just so, you know, no one would see that the Tories don't really have any idea what the fuck they're doing. There were so many options for where that sentence could have gone. Mm-hmm. But
We'll also be talking a little bit of the kind of aftermath of the Conservative Party conference, because, I mean, compared to Labour, they're just tearing themselves apart, bless them. But yeah, after that, we have a third topic, do we not?
We do, indeed.
Oh, it's an old favourite of the Right Dishonourable as well, isn't it?
Yeah, Jezza wants to discuss tuition fees for, you know, reasons best known to himself. Because the Tories have, they've announced they're going to cap tuition fees. So you won't be paying more than, was it $9,200 a year? Or
$9,250, yeah.
50. Mm-hmm. And there's some other thing to do with repayments. As you can tell, I've done a lot of research around this topic. But essentially, the tuition fees won't be going any higher. And presumably, this policy is directed at the Ute to try and get them back to the Tory side of things.
Yeah, so
they all rushed over to vote Labour.
This was, yeah, but Labour are planning on completely getting away, taking away tuition fees, whereas the Conservatives are like, oh, we just won't put them up any more than the 300% we did 5 years ago. Don't worry, guys.
I think it was a 200% increase because they tripled them. You know, maths.
300% is a triple, isn't it?
No. If you raise something by 100%, you double it. If you raise something by 200%, you triple it. If only you'd done maths at university, Jazza, but you wouldn't be able to afford it these days.
No, that is true. I'm actually doing a statistics course as part of my master's right now. But it's more like theory of statistics. So I just have to be like, oh, why do we use a mean or a mode in this particular context? So I don't actually have to do any adding up, so that's fine.
It's all on calculators these days anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Shall we go to the music and then ask the people for money?
If you insist, good sir.
This is the part of the podcast where we ask you guys to give us some cash if you enjoy what we do. To be entirely honest with you, we don't need the money. We can keep this thing running off our own backs, but any money you do give will be appreciated. It will go to things like web hosting, podcast hosting, equipment replacement, any of the myriad costs that go into running this thing. Just go onto the Patreon page, that's patreon.com/rightdishonourable, and set up a monthly donation, a episode-based donation, whatever it is you want to do. Now, I will stop wasting your time, and we will get into the main body of the podcast. So since we last spoke about Catalonia a mere 2 weeks ago, quite a lot has happened. The referendum took place, although not many people voted. I think in the region of about 40% of the potential electorate voted, although 90% of them voted in favour of independence. Meanwhile, the referendum itself was marred by violence from the Spanish police towards voters. We've already discussed the sort of scenes of protesters being beaten up, ballot boxes being seized, and in the wake of it, there's been various kind of diplomatic ruptions. The head of the Catalonian government has said he's going to declare independence, and now the Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy has said that he's thinking about suspending Catalonia's autonomy.
Sorry, I laughed at your pronunciation.
Yeah,
it's Rajoy.
Fucking hell.
Sorry.
All right, I guess you get me back for Erdogan all those years ago, months ago. I should say. I don't know. I'm trying, Jazza. I'm trying. Yeah. This story
classic Englishman abroad. Dos curvetsus, por favor.
You made it so much worse than it was. Anyway, my Spanish pronunciation notwithstanding, this story is developing quite fast, so it's possible by the time we actually release this, even more will have happened. But at the moment, the last thing that's happened is Rajoy is considering suspending Catalonia's autonomy. Jazza, what's your general reaction to the state of affairs that's gone on?
So the video that I made on my channel about this, which was kind of like a history lesson and a bit of an explainer and a reaction to what ended up happening on the day of the referendum, before I made that and before the run-up to this referendum, I genuinely, though the majority of my Spanish friends are from Catalonia and the majority of them are pro-independence and have campaigned for independence for a really long time, I genuinely don't have a huge amount of skin in the game when it comes to Catalonia being an independent country. What I have supported throughout the whole thing and what I have had the opinion of is that they should be able to have a decision of it. They should be able to have a national conversation about it, and they should be able to decide who governs them. And if I were I Catalan, and before this referendum, I didn't really have an opinion on whether Catalonia should be independent or not. And it is about a third, like just under a third of Catalan-speaking Catalans were like pro staying part of the rest of Spain. To be honest,
you mean a third were in favour of leaving.
No, we're in favour of staying part of Spain. So two-thirds of Catalan-speaking Catalans wanted to become an independent country. And it's like a much clearer cultural divide there because there are so many more Catalan speakers in Catalonia than, say, Scots Gaelic speakers in Scotland, like just as a comparison. If I were one of the people in Catalonia, I'd be like, well, you're not. You've decided to deny me democracy in what you, has been a democracy for like the past 40-50 years. I'd be like, well, you guys aren't going to be protecting my rights as a citizen. So I feel like the only option is to now fight to become an independent country. The biggest thing that's kind of happening, apart from so the Catalan president, who has a much harder name to pronounce than Rajoy, it's Puigdemont, I think.
Puigdemont.
It's a Catalan surname. My Catalan is bad. I apologize to any Catalan listeners. But it looks like he's going to be declaring independence regardless in the next few days whenever the Catalan parliament next convenes and votes on this kind of stuff.
It's unclear to me what that means, though, in terms of declaring independence, because
legally it doesn't mean anything.
Well, yeah.
Like within the European Union, it still goes, any kind of thing like that goes through the Spanish courts, and the Spanish courts has deemed this referendum and its result illegal.
Am I right in thinking that the Spanish courts have kind of suspended Catalan's parliament at this stage, so anything that sort of goes on there is kind of void?
At this moment, Rajoy, so it's Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution allows the national parliament in Madrid to intervene with and take over the running of any autonomous region under like circumstances that the central parliament votes on. That hasn't happened yet, but it looks like it could possibly happen. And that is when we get into the possibility of like martial law kind of stuff, which is mad to think about in developed Western Europe, that like loads of British people live there. It's a very international city.
Barcelona is an international
city. Barcelona. And the region as well is like prosperous and wealthy. It's just very jarring to think that that amount of force is possibly going to be used in this region. Rajoy has just played all of his cards absolutely appallingly. He should have just let them get on with the vote and then be like, well, you knew that it was going to be an unconstitutional referendum, so you can't do it. But he's decided to send in all of the federal police, the Guardia Civil, to physically and forcefully crack down on people trying to vote. And no matter where you are in the world, that looks fucking bad.
I'd agree that Rajoy's done very badly in terms of public relations. And I mean, just from a moral point of view, he's behaved terribly. However, it does appear as though he has the stronger position in as much as, legally speaking, he's in the right. And also, by and large, the kind of the rest of the EU, which are the, you know, the other parties that have a stake in this. So I'm talking leaders in Brussels, leaders in France, Germany, all the other member states, don't appear to have any appetite at all to intervene in this situation. So if he ultimately decides, if Rajoy ultimately decides to suspend Catalan's government, sorry, the Catalonian government, and then, you know, just chooses to run it, run Catalonia from Madrid effectively, assuming that there's no kind of, I mean, there's obviously the possibility of civil unrest, but if that doesn't happen, he's effectively won because he's managed to secure the non-independence of Catalonia and therefore retain the sort of tax revenues and the wealth of that region. You know, he's got what he wants out of the situation.
Yeah, but sure, but when you take away the route to independence via democracy, and you've just had this massive crackdown, the only route that a large number of people living in Catalonia now are at least kind of thinking about in terms of independence, the only route now is going to be guerrilla warfare. There's no army specifically for Catalonia. And so there isn't going to be like an all-out war, but there is the potential for there to be an occupied state within the European Union that is then going to have a lot of very passionate people who feel like their right to democracy has been taken away from them. And I feel like the only way to do that is to civil unrest, and like mass kind of like struggle against the institutions that are going to be put in place of the Catalan government. What's been very frustrating for a lot of the Catalan people like after this referendum is that there are many who like the vast majority of people within Catalonia, whether or not you identify as culturally Catalan or not, or whether or not you believe in independence, 70%+ of people believe that there should have been a referendum, or there should be a referendum in Catalonia that is legal and binding. And that number can only have gone up after the crackdown that has happened. And right now, the Catalan government and a lot of the Catalan people are looking for a mediator to be able to encourage people to sit down around a table, to encourage Madrid and Barcelona to sit down around a table and have civilized discussions. Madrid are constantly shutting that down and saying that, no, it's just illegal. This isn't a legal thing that has happened. And there is frustration on the Catalan side that the European Union hasn't stepped in to act as a mediator. But there's obvious reasons why that's happened, because of the fact that when the EU steps in on those negotiations, what happens with the independence movements within Belgium or within France or within Italy or wherever? So there isn't...
Also, Spain, as in the state of Spain, is a stakeholder in the EU in a way that Catalonia isn't. I mean, mm-hmm. Spain is a member of the EU. Catalonia is not a member of the EU. And, you know, to a degree, the EU is not really an appropriate mediator for that reason.
Who would you see as an appropriate mediator for this then? Because I feel like the European Union, as the... If you look at kind of like national and kind of like regional governments being underneath the European Union and the European court and the European kind of like parliament being the highest kind of authority within the European Union, both the Catalan parliament and the Madrid parliament roll up into the European Union. Yes. And so for me, it makes sense to look for mediation from them, even though I do understand why the EU have said no.
Yeah, I mean, my objection would be that Spain has much more influence in the EU than Catalonia does, because Spain, you know, sends MEPs, some of which I suppose probably support Catalan independence. It has representatives in the Brussels bureaucracy. I think it's a bit too much of a... There's a bit of a conflict of interest there, is what I'm trying to say. To answer your question, I mean, this is way outside of my knowledge of international law, but I'd almost say someone like the UN or something like that. Someone that an organisation that isn't quite so connected to the situation and to the Spanish state.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Spain is not. Like, in very recent memory, has had a civil war. Like, they had a civil war in the... 1930s. I believe it was the 30s.
Yeah.
Which resulted in Franco becoming the military dictator of the country. And I think... And the Spanish people and Catalan people learn a lot about that history. Because it's the foundation of the current country that they live in, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the foundation of the current constitutional settlement in Spain.
Yeah, and there are still people who I have met who are alive and kicking who remember the Civil War, let alone the dictatorship of Franco, like have very direct memories of that. And the desire to not go backwards, I feel like because there has been a lack of response from the international community and condemnation from the international community, the only route possible, because Rajoy is so unwilling to sit around a table and actually have any kind of a dialogue with the Catalans, I feel like he is going to have to basically impose martial law on the region, and then Catalans are going to fight back in whichever way they can, because it's going to be second nature to them, because there is living memory of this happening within Spain in the past.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I don't know enough about Catalonia or the country's history to kind of confirm that or otherwise, but I mean, it sort of seems unthinkable to me that you'd get a civil war-esque situation anywhere in the EU, but particularly on the western flank. It just seems kind of impossible, but you know, who really knows at this stage.
When there have been no options for dialogue, and when it has been shut down as this is illegal, and for those who don't know, the Spanish constitution states that Spain is indissoluble, so it cannot then be broken up. And when this was voted on 3 years after Franco in 1978, 90% of the population of Catalonia voted in this to ratify the constitution of Spain. And an overwhelming number of them agreed to it. But the problem is that Spain and Catalonia are now very different countries. And coming out of a... 40-50 year dictatorship of Franco, where Catalans were not allowed to speak their own language, they had cultural practices suppressed, they were not even allowed, they had no regional autonomy or say over their laws whatsoever, they were just signing the first thing that came out that wasn't "we are going to be repressed." And so the idea that they are being told that this document that was ratified in 1978 is the reason that we're not even going to sit around the table and discuss this with you seems incredibly unpalatable for a number of Catalans specifically.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that. I mean, there's one kind of interesting point that that has just struck me that I don't think has been brought up very often is, and you can compare it to the Scottish experience, is that the part of the reason that this is seen as viable is that Catalonia ultimately, if it became independent, would want to join or remain a member of the EU. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, given all we've heard, particularly in the context of the Brexit referendum, about how the EU is actually a force for quelling nationalism and a force for stopping people from thinking of themselves in national terms, where actually, in a certain sense, it has done the exact opposite of that. The fact that the EU provides kind of an international framework for trade and for legal systems and democracy and all of that sort of stuff means that small countries, which otherwise would be seen as less viable or potentially even unviable, such as Catalonia and Scotland and a few of the other places that you mentioned earlier, now think that they can be independent, that they no longer have to bind themselves to a larger nation states like Britain or like Spain.
Yeah, because they already have the protection of the European Union.
Yeah.
I definitely see that. But then I think it also, on the other hand, means that on paper, independence ends up being much more of an identity thing than actually like a viable kind of like financial argument, even though the like places like Scotland and Catalonia have to make those financial arguments because the EU is very lukewarm to the idea of there being independence movements within its membership. And there, when Scotland was having its debate, it remained very unclear whether or not Scotland would remain part of the EU. People tended to lean towards Scotland having to exit and then reapply because it would be a new nation state. What is very interesting is kind of like this tiered identity that Catalans seem to have, and Spanish people seem to have. So there's been a lot of protests within Catalonia. There was a general strike within Catalonia in the past week as well, where people were flying the Catalan flag. And in Madrid and in other cities, people were flying Spanish flags in support of unity. We should say that as well. The rest of Spain does seem to be very anti-Catalan independence, which is interesting that that was never really a loud discussion that happened within the United Kingdom, I don't think. I think most people are like, well, Scottish people need to decide it themselves. But you see Catalan flags, Spanish flags, and European flags being flown in all of those protests. And so those three tiers of within Catalonia of identity of I am Catalan, I am Spanish, and I am European kind of is like this thread that like has been allowed to exist through the European Union. And there is this idea as well, Spain kind of fits into the European Union quite solidly because of the fact that it was such a recent democracy, and a lot of Spanish people do quite enjoy the idea of being part of the European Union because of the fact that it is seen as a guarantor of their democracy. Which is where a lot of the frustrations come from with this incident.
I mean, people sort of say the same of Greece because Greece also had a history of dictatorship post-World War II. Though Greece in many ways has been totally fucked over by the EU in terms of the debt and the whole management of that crisis, there's still a lot of pro-EU feeling in Greece because it is seen as a way of guaranteeing basic civil liberties. I feel we've probably talked this one into the ground. Do you want to move on to...
I could go on about this for hours, Jimmy. Is it not clear?
Well, I suspect there'll be other news items that mean we can bring this back in the coming weeks. So I'm sure you'll get your wish one way or the other.
Oh, I can't wait.
So, are you leading this one or am I?
Yeah, I'll lead it. So it is currently... party conference season in the United Kingdom. So all of our grand, beautiful, historic parties go off to an obscure city sometimes, as long as it's not London.
Cities as obscure as Brighton.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, to be fair, not hugely obscure, but they go to anywhere but London.
Westminster.
Yeah. Just to make sure that everybody knows that they aren't part of the Westminster bubble, even though, well, they very much are. I did enjoy that Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party decided to go as far away as Brighton because all of his shadow cabinet are from North London, and North Londoners do just go down to Brighton for like a bit of a jaunt every now and again.
North Londoners especially?
Yeah, North Londoners especially. Like all of his lot, like the Islingtons and the like the Hackneys and all of that lot, all of the posh wankers.
This for a guy who used to live in Hackney.
Yes. Not and so currently live in Newham, so it's like I'm edgy again now. Yeah. So the Conservatives have just had their conference, and they were up in Manchester, which is an interesting choice, seeing as it's a bit of a Labour stronghold with a Labour mayor. But hey ho, somebody must have booked this very far in advance. And
they were in Manchester last year, weren't they?
Yeah, they're in Manchester quite a lot. I feel like somebody like struck a deal that if we have it here however many years on the trot, then
discount.
Maybe, who knows. It sounds like a very Tory thing to do. More money in your pocket, right?
Economising.
Precisely. Theresa May had a very important speech because it's widely perceived that the Brexit negotiations are not going very well, that she is a bit of a weak leader. Well,
quote, widely perceived.
I mean, is that right? Tell me if that isn't right.
I mean, it is correct that it is widely perceived, because that is probably the truth.
it's just... I'm trying to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, that was generous. That's nice.
Just a reminder, listener, Jimmy's the one that voted to leave the EU.
I voted leave, but I know a shit show when I see it. Yeah.
speaking of shit shows, so it started off a couple of weeks ago. Boris Johnson released a kind of like vision of a vision that he had for Brexit before Theresa May did her famous Florence speech, which kind of talked about there being a longer transitional arrangement. Johnson's article was seen as undermining her in the run-up to the conference, where he would then stage a leadership bid or try and drum up support for there being a leadership. And people were talking about that in the first couple of days of the conference, and then Theresa May did her coughing fit on stage and basically lived out in real time everybody's like nightmare that they have before they have a very important presentation to do at work the morning before, the morning after. And God, it just, everything that, as you said, Jimmy, everything that perceivably went wrong.
And also, you know, a comedian handed her a P45, which most people probably wouldn't have predicted as on their list of things that could go wrong while giving a speech.
There were then a couple of backbench Tory MPs, kind of. Like Grant Shapps said that they should get rid of Theresa May and people should start running for the leadership.
So he was the former chair of the Tory party, and he was some kind of junior minister in the Cameron administration. Is that right?
Yes.
That sounds right.
Correct. But now there seems to have been, there's been the leaking of a WhatsApp conversation amongst all of the kind of like Tory front benches. Can I just side note and say I love the fact that the Tory cabinet use WhatsApp in order to do like party whipping now.
Well, they're a modern party, Jazza. They're not, you know, constantly stuck in the past.
So modern. Very interesting that Theresa May wants us to ban encryption of information shared on social media sites, and they've chosen to use WhatsApp, which is an encrypted platform. But anyway, I'm not going to talk about that.
One rule for the Oiks, one for everyone else.
Precisely. But Boris Johnson has been quoted from that WhatsApp group as saying that everybody needs to rally round behind the Prime Minister while she gets rid of her cough. What was your reaction to what happened to Theresa May? How much of it did you watch?
I mostly just picked up the highlights on like Guardian Live, I think. And I obviously saw people tweeting about the various mishaps. I didn't watch the speech. I generally find speeches are kind of a waste of time because it's mostly waffle anyway. But yeah, I saw it, and aside from the reaction of laughter, I don't really think this changes anything. I know it, you know, it generated a load of negative press the morning after, and it did serve as like a superb metaphor for how the Tories are at the moment. And, you know, in 10 years' time, when they're making documentaries about this, the entire Tory conference is going to be a fucking gift to any of the directors. But, you know, beyond that, what does it really change? The Tory party is as much of a shit show now as it was before the conference. I don't think it will have changed a lot of people, the public's opinion of her, because she's already perceived as being weak. If anything, I mean, you said before we started recording that you felt sympathy for her. And certainly some of the people I spoke to who aren't exactly fans of Theresa May had a similar reaction. But broadly speaking, what exactly is it the Tories can do at this point? They can replace her, but they could have replaced her after the general election. I don't really see why there's any more incentive to do that now than there was previously.
But our next general election is meant to be in 2022, right?
Yes, although I don't think anyone's taking that date particularly seriously at this point.
But then at what point does somebody, because there are clearly people who are chomping at the bit to be the next Prime Minister and the leader of the Tory party. So the reason that that isn't happening is because she has a minority government, and who wants to inherit that? And then the possibility of going back to an election where Labour are surging and look like a much more competent party. And I never thought we'd be saying that about a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party, but I guess that they're very good at keeping their mouth shut when everything is collapsing on the other side of the aisle.
I don't think they do look... I mean, so this is someone who reads a lot of political news. I don't think Labour do look much more competent. I mean, their position on Brexit is just as convoluted and contradictory as the Tories is.
They're just being very... They're being deliberately vague, right?
Well, they're saying...
Which
you know,
is what this... you would be if you were in their situation.
Yeah, I mean... You could say that, but there's also just like a bunch of people within the Tory cabinet that just blatantly shouldn't be in office. Although, sorry, I meant to say the Labour cabinet, but it actually applies equally to both parties. you know, rearrange that sentence however you want. But yeah, I aside from the minority government thing, there's also the, you know, the small matter of actually carrying out Brexit negotiations, which I assume is playing some part in the calculation of various Tory ministers who actually care about the country they run rather than, you know, just glory hunters like Boris Johnson. But yeah, I mean, it's... I think if it wasn't for the minority government thing and if it wasn't for... Actually, I'm not sure the minority government thing is a deciding factor, but the fact that Brexit is taking place and negotiations are ongoing, I think is probably the main reason why she hasn't been ousted.
Do you think because nobody wants to pick up that mantle?
I think it would be a total... I mean, the Brexit negotiations are already going terribly badly, and I think if, you know, if Theresa May had any sense at all, she would... Or, you know, if she had some bottle, she'd probably just suspend Article 50 and, take the whole thing back to the drawing board.
I've read a lot of... like, obviously, with a government in this kind of crisis, you get a lot of leaks. And I've read leaks that have varied along the spectrum of Theresa May and her cabinet and the Department for Exit in the EU are now getting ready for a no-deal scenario to Theresa May is going to pause Article 50, because the thing about Article 50 in the European Union is that nobody ever thought that Article 50 would be triggered. And so there are no kind of details around it. And so the possibility of pausing Article 50 does seem actually to be possible.
I think it's more a diplomatic question than a legal one, strictly speaking. And there have been various kind of legal analyses on whether or not you could pause Article 50. As you say, it's not a very comprehensively written piece of legislation. So it doesn't really say. But I think Emmanuel Macron... And even Angela Merkel said something along the lines of they'd be open to the idea of Britain pausing Article 50 and kind of reassessing the situation. I mean, I ultimately still think we should leave. And I'd still think that even if I voted Remain, because we had a vote and whatever problems there were with the referendum, it seems to me it was a legitimate exercise in democracy. And it would be terrible, I think, to flout that. But that doesn't mean we have to leave as soon as possible. And it obviously doesn't mean we should leave in a totally arse-backward way either.
What if the only option was leaving in an arse-backward way?
I don't think that's the case. I'm going to pull a Tony Blair trick now and just refuse to answer a hypothetical question. I always thought there was going to be some disruption, but I mean, just the way things appear to be going... And it almost doesn't matter which like newspaper you read at this point. It just seems to be a total fucking disaster, and it seems to be going way too fast, and so many details need to be worked out before we leave, and there doesn't appear to be a cohesive strategy. I've just no idea what's going on, really, but it doesn't look good from this vantage point. Maybe the press reportings are misleading and, you know, the government actually has it in hand. But I am skeptical.
No, I don't think that's the case.
I'm skeptical is all.
So on my like suggested articles that I get every morning, I keep on getting, because Google knows that I'm a Brim owner. Like I feel like that's very clear from my content and my output. And they keep on recommending me, it's generally Guardian articles that are like, here's this little known fact that could possibly mean that we're staying in the EU and that everything's going to not actually happen. And I started off quite liking the idea of having all of these possibilities of Brexit not happening, but now have started to resent these publications giving me hope, like clickbaiting my anti-Brexit feelings. And so now I feel like I've done a 180. I'm just like, no, we should just leave now.
Yeah, it seems to me also, like, as much as people feel sorry for Theresa May and the position that she's found herself in, she really, like, totally fucked up when she triggered Article 50 before having the general election. She got those two events
the wrong way around.
And she has no one to blame but herself in those circumstances. And having triggered Article 50, it was very fucking irresponsible to then call a general election, even if she'd won it, or even if she'd come back with, you know, the same amount of seats virtually. She would have wasted, like, 2 months, basically, on actually the general election being carried out. Why on earth did she do that? And why has she not been more roundly criticised for such a flagrantly stupid move?
I feel like she has been widely criticised for it. But the thing is, I think
been criticised on the grounds that it's harmed her own position. But really, the position who it's harmed the most is the country's position.
Nationalist Jimmy is talking.
It's not even a nationalist point. It's just like, you know, her job is to serve the United Kingdom. In one way or the other, and she fucking failed to do that in a very obvious and stupid way. And you know, for that alone, that's grounds that she should actually be out of a job at this point. But you know, the Tory party being what it is and the political situation being what it is, she's managed to cling on.
Yeah, it's a little bit crazy. Shall we talk about one of the policy decisions that she tried to distract us with that we're totally going to take the bait of?
She tried to distract us with policy while she was coughing.
Yeah, like, tuition fees.
To cover up from the asthma attack that took place on stage.
Oh, no, let her.
Yeah,
we just wanted to give her a hug. Poor lady.
Oh, she's not. She's not poor. She fucking deserves to be seen as a fucking flop. Like, she deserves that. That should be her legacy.
But like my visceral reaction is I feel so sorry for you that that's happened, and then I have to go back and remember that I disagree with her on almost all of her policy decisions, despite the fact that I'm actually starting to quite like her and feel sorry for her as a person. Yeah. And so like reminding myself of that, I don't know. I empathise with people, Jimmy. I don't know about you. You might be a sociopath, but I'm not.
I think this is just a Linton Crosby tactic to get some of the Guardianistas on side. He's like, we need people feeling sorry for her, and then they'll forget what a fucking waste of space she is.
Well, no, somebody who helped head up the Gordon Brown Labour campaign in 2010 said that she knew when it was going badly. Because when people stopped being angry at Gordon Brown and started feeling sorry for him.
Well, it's been going badly for Theresa May ever since the general election. Actually, before the general election.
Bless her. So anyway, her policies.
Nah, that's okay, fine. We'll talk about some policies then. That's some actual, important stuff.
Yeah. So Theresa May, every day of the conference, had like a policy that she was kind of rolling out that was kind of awkwardly overshadowed by the fact that Labour had done a very similar thing like a few days before. And the Tory position seemed to be watered down versions of the Labour policies.
Surely not.
Because, like, weirdly, and I never thought we'd be saying this, the Overton window of politics has been dragged left, kicking and screaming, by Jeremy Corbyn, offering to renationalise everything and provide free tuition for people going to university.
Do you want to explain to the listeners what the Overton window is, if they're not already familiar?
Yeah, so the Overton window is basically the spectrum of acceptable political ideas from left to right, that kind of shift. So if, for example, society has a right-leaning Overton window, stuff like free tuition and nationalised healthcare are less palatable to the public, but you can change kind of like where that Overton window is on the spectrum through discourse and activism, etc., etc., etc. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I always thought that whatever, however successful Jeremy Corbyn was electorally, he would probably make some of the policies that he advocates for more acceptable. I always thought that was going to be, so, but that, I mean, if you listen to like commentators like Owen Jones, The Guardian, he's long complained that things like renationalising the rail service has been a popular policy, I think, for years and years, and yet neither Labour nor the Tories have actually backed it as a policy kind of since Blair took power. But obviously Jeremy Corbyn's now changed that.
We specifically are going to be talking about Theresa May's policy to freeze tuition fees at £9,250 a year, and then raising the earnings repayment threshold for students from £21,000 to £25,000. So that means that you don't start paying back your student loans until you're earning over £25,000 a year. Currently, with the cap, with the threshold at £21,000, it means that 73% of people will never pay back their student loans.
In full or pay them back at all?
Because they get written off after, I believe, 30 years anyway.
But you're saying that 75% of people will never pay it back in full, but they will pay some of it back.
Yes, exactly. Right. And then raising it to £25,000 a year, over 80% of people will not be paying back those loans in full. Mm-hmm. I don't know a huge amount about tax and stuff, but I feel like that's how. I feel like that's, and like debt and things and all of that.
Just money, like, in general.
Yeah, I've watched The Big Short and have had stuff like explained to me by naked women in baths, but hey ho. but basically, I feel like people not paying back loans in full, that's how like financial crashes happen.
I think you're overthinking this a little bit.
Okay.
It's only student loans, you know.
Yeah. So actually, the reason I wanted us to talk about this is because we have talked about it in the past. It's something that we enjoy to do. But also, as well as being a podcast where one person voted Leave and one person voted Remain, one of us went to university and one of us didn't.
Oh, yeah. I forgot I'm the more diverse person in this respect. This is how this works, right? I'm not really familiar.
It is the only thing that you get, Jimmy, though, to be fair. So Jimmy, as the one who didn't go to university, how do you feel about the possibility of tuition fees being frozen at this threshold or completely taken away as Labour have suggested?
So I think there's at least two aspects to this question, which is like how well structured is the current tuition fees set up in terms of actually where does the burden lie, and is it sort of economically efficient? And from the scant amount of reading that I did before we started recording this, and also just previously looking vaguely into how tuition fees pan out, it does seem like a very badly structured system. It seems like it's bad not only for the... it's costly for the students themselves, but it's costly for the taxpayer, because effectively the debt is like... Effectively, the government loans money to students, and then that debt is sold as a kind of asset to a private company, which is called the Student Loans Company. I think I have that correct. Yeah. And
I get passive aggressive emails from them. Sometimes.
Right. Okay. And basically, it doesn't really work out very well for the taxpayer because, as you say, a lot of the students aren't paying back, and that appears to be increasing over time. And also the debt, such that it is being charged an increasingly high rate of interest. So it's now like 6.1%, you pay 6.1% on the money you borrow or something in that region. Always very scared about quoting figures here because it's easy to get them wrong. But I mean, the upshot of it is that we have a very, very expensive student loan system that not only pisses off students, but doesn't really work out very well for the taxpayer. So however it is that you reform the system, I think you have to change it radically. I mean, the way it functions at the moment is like a sort of quasi... graduate tax, the idea being that if you're a graduate you pay a little bit more income tax, and that's kind of how it works, and it's tapered in various ways. But, you know, that's kind of all by the by, I think. The larger question that you presumably want to get to is actually how much should an individual student be paying for their higher education, i.e. their university education?
Yeah, so I don't believe that people shouldn't pay tuition fees.
So you do believe they should pay tuition fees?
Yeah, sorry for the difference. I think that tuition fees are kind of like a sensible way of having a fair kind of like the burden being shouldered fairly across people who benefit from university education. So there's the idea that why should somebody who isn't going to university like Jimmy pay for me to go to university? And so it tended to be when we didn't have tuition fees, it tended to benefit middle class and upper class families because they were able to increase their kind of like financial mobility, their economic mobility, because poorer people who would never go to university were paying taxes to support their education, essentially. And I think that putting that burden onto the families or the individual who's going to university is through having a student loan and then repaying that loan makes sense to me. I feel like as soon as they increased it to 9,000 plus pounds, even though there seems that it looks like there are more economically diverse people going to university now, the number of people who are not going to be paying back their loans just seems absolutely insane and ridiculous to me. Mm. And I agree with you in terms of how efficient it is for the taxpayer. I don't understand why we don't have a graduate tax.
I don't sort of know how that would work out specifically. It just, you know, seems obvious that the current financial setup doesn't work very well for anyone apart from the private company that's making money off the interest.
So one of the things that one of the scenarios that really makes me annoyed about the current tuition fee system that we have is the fact that rich families are able to subsidize their kids' education and they can graduate without any interest. Mm. And so actually their education is for all intents and purposes free for them, but is kind of like paid off really, really quickly by their families. And so it continues to be the middle and lower income people who go to university who end up paying far more in the long term for
university. I think that's not quite true what you said. Basically the way I've heard the current system summarized is it's the middle earners that get clobbered. So mm-hmm. if you're a high earner, as you say, your mummy and daddy pays off the fees and the sort of living costs immediately. Yeah. So you don't accrue any interest.
Yeah.
And if you're a low earner, so say you go to university, you get your degree, but you never enter the income fresh, you never hit the income threshold that would trigger repayments. You never pay anything.
So that's not what I'm saying. What I mean is people who have very rich parents who are able to pay it off quickly never end up having to pay the interest on those loans.
Yes.
But those who come from lower income backgrounds, go to university and then have a middle income job, have made themselves economically upwardly mobile, they end up then paying far more than people from middle and higher income families, if that makes sense.
Whereas a graduate tax
would end up completely eradicating that and making sure that everybody ended up paying a fair amount of for the education that they had based on how much money they were actually earning.
Yeah, I mean, I think we agree that a simple graduate tax would just do the job better. But I don't know. I mean, my kind of view on university anyway is I think it's pretty confused as to why we're sending quite so many young people to university in the first place. Because all of this was set off by the Blair government's decision to get 50% of people going to university.
Yeah, I believe that was a goal that they never actually hit, though, right?
Have they hit it now? I don't know.
I don't think so. I think it peaked at like 48 or something and then has gone a little bit further down.
Yeah, possibly. But it's certainly much higher than it used to be, where, you know, going to university was in and of itself a massive privilege that was only granted to a select proportion of society. But I don't know. I think that university's kind of evolved as an old institution to deal with an old way of actually training people to enter the workforce. And obviously you can still say that university is a great place to actually sort of enrich yourself, experience new things, fucking get pissed and shag about. But does it, like, what role does, like, do humanities degree, and I know I'm going to pick on these because the role of science degrees is far more obvious, what role do humanities degrees actually play in contributing to building the wealth in the wider economy over time? And if there is, like, a benefit to that, I don't think it's been proven. I don't think it's been demonstrated. You can say that education in a general sense is good for society, but, you know, that seems to me to be a bit thin.
So I did languages for my undergraduate, and languages are the second highest earners after third highest earners after medics and like mathematics.
Yeah, but learning a language is effectively a technical skill, isn't it?
But essentially I learned to write about movies in other languages for 4 or 5 years. Like, that's what my degree was.
Yeah, but, you know, if you look at it from a utilitarian point of view, even if me and you had exactly the same skills, but you had, you know, fluent Spanish speaker, fluent Mandarin speaker, you're obviously more employable than me. And that, you know, the more employable you are, the wider amount of opportunities you have, the higher chance it is you're going to get a higher paying job. I don't think there is this thing known as the graduate premium, which is if you have a degree, you're more likely to earn a higher amount over time than if you don't have a degree, all other things taken into account. But I actually think that says more. Obviously, there are some technical jobs where your degree is directly linked to you earning more money. But to some extent, I think it is merely the case that graduates, and particularly middle class and posh graduates, have just colonized a lot of the best jobs that you frankly don't need a degree for. And there is this drive among employers,
and are also able to work for free in sectors like journalism, like fashion, for example, for longer periods of time because they're able to be subsidized by their privileged backgrounds.
Well, the wider point I'm making is that I think that even though education is always seen as this, you know, great promoter of social mobility, I don't think it is in all cases. And I think one of the cases in which it definitely isn't is the case in which, you know, the middle classes and the upper classes dominate the best universities and therefore go on to get the plum jobs. And there is this drive among certain employers to actually run sort of non-graduate schemes, as in, like, take in you know, hire people who don't straight from school or who've been out in the workforce for a little while, and then sort of see how they do. And some of those schemes have proved that, you know, quite obviously, people who don't have degrees can be just as productive, or if not more productive than people who do have degrees. And I think rather than channeling everyone into university education, I think the kind of training sort of outlook of Britain and other Western countries should be more in line with that. We should stop being focused on university education so exclusively. Rant over.
No, it was very good. One final thing that I wanted to talk about on this topic before we wrapped up was this apparent... I was actually really surprised when Theresa May decided to freeze tuition fees, and she's planning on having a consultation of it, so there may also be yet another iteration of how we pay for tertiary education in this country. This is clearly because a mainstream party now says that it's going to offer free university education, at least at the point of the education, to young people, that party being Jeremy Corbyn's Labour. What do you think are the consequences of the Tories now trying to adopt policies from the Labour Party?
I mean, really, that was, you know, a significant part of the Cameron project was to sanitise the Tory party and by stealing quite a lot of policies from Labour. And I think, you know, the left always seems kind of beleaguered and it always feels that it's under siege. But over the, you know, since the post-war period, Labour have won a lot of arguments and the left has won a lot of arguments over time. And it often doesn't really take stock to actually say, look, we won this. These are now non-negotiable things. These are not, this is not the alternative to what we've won here is not part of the Overton window, to link back to the yeah. start of this conversation. So I in that sense it's not that remarkable, but you know, obviously it is the case that the Tories are policy wise and just intellectually speaking fairly rudderless at the moment. And because Theresa May's position's so weak, she can't campaign for any of the things that she talked about when she became Prime Minister and leader of the Tory party. But I don't think that's going to change. I don't think Theresa May will ever have a significant policy impact on this country beyond how she handles Brexit. Mm-hmm. That would probably be true even if she did have a solid majority to be working with, but the fact that she doesn't means that Brexit is pretty much all she has left, and the fact that they're stealing policies from Labour I think is just desperation rather than anything else.
And that's why I just feel so sorry for her. You remember that speech that she did when she became Prime Minister on the steps of Number 10, and she was like, if you're poor, then you are less likely to go to university, blah 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 blah, all of that. She has a vision for the country that she wants to build, and it seems like a noble, fair vision, and she's not going to be able to fucking do it because of all of this Brexit bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but she knew that when she took the fucking job, didn't she? So I'm not liking this pity and sympathy that we're showing towards Theresa May. Who does want to read your emails, Jazza? She is a deeply sinister woman.
Yeah, and thank you for I do just need to be reminded of that again and again.
Yeah, she's yeah. I mean, she's basically a fascist. That's basically what I'm
okay,
saying.
Okay, now you've lost me.
I'm having to ramp up the rhetoric, you know, to appeal to young people. We need, you know, an anti-Tory yeah. podcast. That's how this works now.
No,
right?
No, Jimmy, we're making the centre sexy again.
All right, Trump. All right. Calm down.
Jimmy, where can they find you if they want to
praise me for my amazing views, forthcoming radical views on education?
Yeah, then.
I meant forward-looking rather than forthcoming, but I suppose that's still applies, roughly speaking.
Whatever you want to say. Where can they find you? For fuck's sake, just tell us.
At JDE Nichols.
On Twitter.
On Twitter. You criticised me once for saying on Twitter, yeah. And now I haven't said it and you've criticised me again, so there's just no winning with you.
I know, it's brilliant, isn't it? You can find me at Jazza John. Please go to writedishonorable.com where you can read articles by Jimmy. And if you are interested in bonus content, outtakes and the like, hop over to our Patreon and pledge us like a dollar or so. It would be really wonderful to be supported by you. Love you lots.
Bye-bye.
Bye.